This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQBar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
60% of top distributors run on Epicor Profit 21. It's ERP built for distribution, enhanced with agentic AI that doesn't just inform, but acts. Optimizing inventory, streamlining purchasing, and making every day easier. Don't play catch up. Visit epicor.com/win.
Hi, folks! Coming to you live for about another 15 seconds, because we're going to take you here on the Brilliantly Dumb Show over to our interview with Animal Planet's Forrest Galante. We went to his house 2 weeks ago, me and Joey Coldcuts, dressed up in camo and a fedora, looking absolutely ridiculous, and he took us on a tour of his whole animal sanctuary. Now, if you want to go check it out, kind of get a reference for what you're looking at and what we're talking about, head on over to the YouTube, The Brilliantly Dumb Show on YouTube. Take a look. We just posted yesterday of the whole tour we did with him. He's a ball buster. He's a character. It was a lot of fun. It was action-packed, as always. I loved it. I've watched it 5 times already. I just think it's really good content. Not an animal guy, so I had no business being there, which kind of plays to the whole thing. So we're going to take you over now to our interview with Animal Planet's Forrest Galante, coming in hot. Grace Ibrahim, moving on. All right, folks, here we are, the Brilliantly Dumb Show. I'm here with nature's finest, Sir Forrest Galante, Animal Planet, host of Extinct or Alive. Forrest, thanks for being on the Brilliantly Dumb Show.
Hey, thanks for
having
me, guys.
Welcome
Cheers.
Aboard.
Yeah.
And may I also say, we have Joey Coldcuts here as well. Forrest, how ridiculous did we look coming up? I mean, when you saw us walking up, did we just look ridiculous?
No comment. No, you guys are good, man. You look great. I mean, it's, you know, this is not your typical spot, right?
With that being said, on another lighter note, I feel bad for the mailman that has to get up here. I mean, for the people, if you could see where we are right now, what we had to do to get up here, this is bizarre.
It is. Yeah, we're out there.
Did you ever think, is it weird for you to look back, let's say 15 years ago, and realize what you're doing right now?
Oh, it's crazy. It's absolutely nuts, man. 15 years ago, I was working biological odd jobs, making $14 an hour, you know, picking weeds, counting ants, tagging foxes, you know, just like I was a biotech, you know. I was starting to author papers and stuff like that, but it's not where I am today, that's for sure.
And even back then, was something like this in mind that you had? What was the goal for you?
Well, I shouldn't say no. I should say yes and no, because I always had an innate fascination with critically endangered, edge of extinction stuff. But I never expected to be on a podcast. I don't think podcasts existed 15 years ago. But, you know, on a TV show, hosting a TV show, having my own programs, having my own production company, you know, working with wildlife around the world the way that I do. All I knew and have known since I was very little is that I would work with wildlife my whole life. That's it. I didn't know it would amount to this.
So, right, you're not in a job right now. You're living your dream.
Yeah, 100%, every day.
Unbelievable. And, you know, for lack of a better word, you're a crazy son of a gun. I mean, I've seen the show. You've been, what, bitten by 2 sharks?
Uh-huh.
Mauled by a lion?
I have.
What else is on the
what
list?
What is that got to be like, yeah, getting mauled by a lion?
Well, that's probably, like, the worst story of all of them. But, let's see. Man-o-war jellyfish, venomous sea snake bite. I've been in 2 plane crashes now, 2 shark bites, stung by a stingray, the lion. I've had a couple different hippo attacks. Wow. Yeah, you know, there's been a couple.
Another day at the office here for Forrest Galante.
Occupational hazard, you know?
Well, let's, if I can pinpoint one, let's start with the plane crash. What, you've been in two plane crashes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How, I mean, what,
one
how, what
happened?
That's right.
Yeah. You doubled down.
That's right. Still here, baby.
What, and how did that, was that out on one of your adventures?
No, actually. So I grew up in Zimbabwe, in the bush in southern Africa, and my family owned safari businesses. And when I was a kid, my mom was the bush pilot. So we used to fly our little Cessna 310 into camp, which was a dirt strip in the middle of the bush, and then go into safari from there. So anyway, when I was like 13, maybe 12, we were flying in, and my mom was flying, and I was the co-pilot, and the back was full of supplies getting ready to set up. And we got nailed by lightning, and all the instruments went out. So, you know, planes get hit by lightning.
How high up in the air were you when it got hit?
I can't recall. I mean, probably 10, 12,000 feet. You know, we're up there. We weren't, like, taking off or landing. We were cruising. And getting hit by lightning, you know, it was a bad storm, first of all. And we got hit by lightning, which does happen. Planes are made for it. But it fried all our instruments. And so then when we came down for the landing, it was all by sight and by feel. And as we came down for the landing, one of the wheels that came down hit a termite mound. And so as it hit the termite mound, it ripped the wheel well off. So the plane started spinning like this, and then it caught an edge and started spinning like this.
And your co-pilot at this time, your mom?
She's 12 years old.
12 years old, yeah, co-pilot.
12 years old, I couldn't do my homework on that.
Yeah, well, it's a different upbringing in Africa. You kind of buck up pretty young over there. I started driving myself to school at about 10. So, you know, it's a little different in Zimbabwe. But, yeah, so anyway, yeah, and the plane crashed, and then we were stuck in the bush for a few days, and then help came, and we were just bruised and banged up. Nobody was badly injured. Because my mom was such a good pilot,
she was able to land it okay?
Yeah, I mean, not okay. The plane was totaled.
Right.
Yeah.
And then what about the second one? Similar?
No, the second one was for a Discovery Channel show, and it was not as good of a story by any means, but we were, the plane was coming in to land and just went off the end of the runway. Just came in too hot, went straight off the end of the runway, ripped one of the wings off and into the trees. Again, both times just bangs and bruises, nothing too bad. Pilot was a little shook up on that one.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Boys, if you could explain to the viewers who don't know, extinct or alive, how did the show come about? If you could just explain a little bit on the show.
Yeah, for sure. So Extinct is, it's an interesting story. Don't know how far back you want me to go. But I've always been fascinated by wildlife, right? It's like I said, my whole life, it's what I've known I'm going to do. When I did a show for Discovery Channel called Naked and Afraid, the same show that the plane crashed on. And when I got back from that, just like everybody who does Naked and Afraid, I got my 5 minutes of fame, right? Like all the reporters contact you and go, oh my God, like you were naked in the jungle. What's that all about? And I was just a biologist at this time, and I did it as a fun challenge. Never thought I'd work in TV. Never, didn't even fill out a casting application. I just sent in a cocky email saying I'm better than the guys that do this currently.
Like the Bear Grylls kind of people?
Yeah, survivalists. So I went out and did that show and came back. The show came out, and I was the highest-rated survivalist the show had ever had, right? Like, I didn't break down. I didn't cry. I didn't get miserable. I was just like, this is fun. This is stupid. This is easy. Like, this isn't really a challenge. This is just me running around the woods with my dick out for 21 days.
And, we've all been there.
Yeah, yeah.
You were crash-lining planes at 12.
Yeah, I mean, like, I've never understood the guys that cry, and girls, too. You know, guys and girls, they cry and moan and get upset, and they cry, talk about how terrible it is. Like, yeah, it sucks. Like, you're naked, you're cold, you're hungry, but that's what you signed up for. Like, what do you expect to happen?
Kind of like me doing the snake, trying the snake.
Basically,
yeah, that's what I signed up for.
But anyway, I got back from that and I got my 5 minutes of fame because I did so well on the show. And then all these reporters started contacting me, right? Like, oh, tell me about Naked and Afraid. And I was like, nah, I'm good. Like, what do you mean? Like, I don't want to talk about Naked and Afraid. Like, what?
Because of how many questions you were getting about it?
No, I didn't want to work in TV. I wanted to be a biologist. I didn't care about being famous. I didn't care about TV. So when these reporters started coming at me, I was like, you know what? I'm not interested in talking about that, but I'll tell you about the wildlife work I do. Show you some photos of me, you know, finding the first ever hammerhead in California waters, or catching the largest lobster that the state's ever seen, or, you know, tagging seagulls, or some of the work that I've done if you want to see that. And the reporters at the time were kind of reluctantly like, yeah, okay, I guess we can tie that into what
you're
doing.
Look into it.
Yeah. And so all of a sudden, like six of these absolutely viral news stories blew up of this guy that does this crazy wildlife work, right? The guy who found the biggest lobster and the guy who got chased by a hammerhead in California, which has never happened before, and like all this stuff like blew up. And then I had all these like agents start contacting me. They're like, hey, we got to rep you, and basically we want to capitalize on your 10 minutes of fame. And I was like, yeah, I'm good.
So this is still at a time where you don't want any part of TV.
No, I'm a biologist. I'm working on the Channel Islands out here. You know the islands you can see from my window right there? That's where I'm working.
Beautiful view, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah,
I like it.
Your
turtles have the best view in this entire... Yeah, like, did you see the view Sylvester has?
Yeah, he's got it good.
Sylvester's living good.
Yeah, not bad for a rescue out of West L.A.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Talk about an upgrade.
Yeah. Anyway, so the story is way too long, but basically I had all these agents contact me. I said, I have no interest in an agent, no interest in capitalizing on it. I just wanted to do this for exposure, right, for the wildlife that I do. You know, like bring some attention to wildlife work in California. Anyway, one of the agents said, all right, cool. Well, we don't need a rep you or anything, but just meet with this producer, sit down with him and see what he says. So I sat down with this producer, a young guy, he's like my age, and he had produced a bunch of television, but he's super passionate about wildlife and the outdoors like I am. He's like, let's create a show and pitch it. So over a brunch and about five of these, we came up with Extinct or Alive. Yeah, we came up with Extinct or Alive. And then it took us 2 years from that brunch until we finally got a yes for a pilot.
So, but going down and sitting with the producer, he was able to get you on board to now you're okay with going on TV?
Yeah, well, I was never against it. Like, I can tell you why I was never against it. When I was in college, after 2 years, I published a paper. Very, very well-written paper in a very notable scientific publication. That got 400 reads. 400 reads by like-minded academics who already knew the subject matter. Right? When I did my first television show, Naked and Afraid, that got 4 million views on the first night. Right? You tell me which one of those two is more impactful. Like, I'm not a huge academic. I'm really not. I'm more of a hands-on kind of guy. And I didn't want to be a scientist who sat in an office writing grants my whole life. I'd rather be a field scientist. And so when I saw those numbers of what a television show can reach and how many kids it can inspire, even if that one was stupid survival nudity, like, you know, that I figured this is great. If I can do conservation on a platform like television, that's all I need to do.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and here we are, multiple seasons later.
and when you go out to these places around the world, how much research goes into before you go to see if, you know, even if an animal is even extinct or not, how much research goes into that before you even go out there?
Years, yeah. Every hour of television that you see is the culmination of years of research, months of planning, and weeks in the field.
Right.
So it's, you know, as we sit right now on my computer back there, I've got a database of 1,600 animals that are declared extinct that presumably could still be out there. Each of those animals has reasons they could be there. There are different locations all around the world, from the Arctic to the Amazon. And, you know, I prioritize them based on, well, a bunch of variables, but the weather, the time of year, the animal's ecology, you know, what I can get funding for, everything else.
Let me ask you some, Forrest. What's an animal that you have not been able to find yet, but you're so certain that it's out there?
The thylacine.
And what is that?
The Tasmanian tiger. Have you ever heard of it?
Till now?
Yeah.
Not exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Tasmanian tiger is this absolutely incredible marsupial carnivore. So marsupial is like a kangaroo, right? It lives in Australia, has a pouch, an animal with a pouch. And it's a carnivore, and it's called a tiger because it has stripes like a tiger, but it has the body of a wolf and the jaw structure of a snake, where it can open its jaws almost 180 degrees.
Out of Greek mythology.
Yeah, it's an incredible creature.
It's like you eating a Big Mac.
A little bit.
It's an incredible animal, and they existed until not very long ago, because Westerners wiped them out. There's even single video footage of one from the Hobart Zoo in Tasmania, and I am pretty convinced that this animal still exists in very small populations. And I've spent more than 3 months looking for them so far in the field and not found one, and I'm not done yet.
Is it something that bothers you at night? Like, do you lose sleep over it?
Oh, absolutely. I have many a very late night sitting right there researching that animal and many others. I mean, I definitely lose sleep over it.
So when you find one of these animals that they think is extinct, what is the process that goes in? Are you trying to rehabilitate it, like, to back into population? Or, like, what do you do from that point forward?
So when an animal is declared extinct, all funding dries up for, right? Extinct means gone. It means it doesn't exist any longer, right? A dinosaurs are extinct. There's not a lot of funding to preserve.
He's going to have a T-Rex just roaming around here.
It's a season five.
Yeah, next to the rabbit, there's not a lot of, you know, there's no funding to conserve dinosaurs, right? It doesn't exist because they're gone. Well, that's the same thing when an animal gets the extinction classification, right? So when we are able to prove that an animal still exists, we're able to unlock funding to preserve and protect it. So millions of dollars, conservation dollars, go into saving these species. Because obviously if we find it, it's on the critically endangered list, right? Meaning it's on the very edge. There's one or two or three of them left, period. So that's kind of the driving force behind why I do this. Because once we find something, then all these conservation dollars are unlocked to try and preserve it. That, and it inspires if I showed you what my Instagram messages look like right now, if I just refresh them, you'd see 10 more kids go, oh my God, when I grow up, I want to be a biologist because of your TV show.
It's awesome.
You know.
It must validate everything you do.
Everything. And it makes the shark bites and the amoebic dysentery and the fevers and the broken ankle and the everything else that happens basically every year worth it.
But even to go into some of these places, what type of clearance do you have to get? How many people do you have to talk to in order to get there and get approval to go wherever it may be?
Oh, it's massive. It's massive. Yeah, I mean, I have a whole team of people that's their entire job is getting
that.
Yeah. And of course, you know, we're funded by Discovery and Animal Planet, and so we have to dot all our I's and cross all our T's. As a younger man, I would have just swooped in there and gone for it, you know. But now we got to make sure that everything, you know, the insurance is done, and then like the country's on board, and the local government bodies are on board, and the IUCN's a part of it, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. You know, we have a lot of paperwork to do for every single expedition. It sucks because I hate paperwork. I'm a field guy,
right, but
it's part of what we have to do, and it does help when we are successful in the discovery because we have all of our I's dotted and our T's crossed. Then it can, you know, straight away go towards the animal and not, oh, why were you there? You know, you didn't have the right piece of paper to say you could be there, or you were filming, or, you know, whatever.
I don't see you being a paperwork guy.
I'm not. Yeah,
I really don't.
It's a good assessment.
Have you ever been uncomfortable?
You mean aside from this interview?
Of course he's been uncomfortable.
Yeah, no, I mean, have I ever been uncomfortable? Yeah, I mean, plenty. Like, I've puked my brains out from sicknesses and diseases on these trips. I've fractured my foot on a trip. I got bitten by a shark on a trip, you know. Tens of thousands of mosquitoes, you know, there's, I can show you pictures where my feet are black because they're covered in mosquitoes. Like, you can't even see skin because they're so bad. You know, I'm uncomfortable more times than I'm not during my expeditions.
So, Forrest, let me ask him, it's got to happen often when you go on these trips. Is there any in particular time where something just didn't go according to plan?
It's literally every single expedition. Like, I think one of the reasons that my team and I are so successful, not just in finding stuff, but in having a television show, is because of how dynamic we are. Like, what I mean by that is we live in a generation, a time and place where everything's so, like, single use, like, call someone when you have a problem. Like, you can't call someone when we have a problem. Like, you know, let's say our plan is we're going to fly into Colombia, then we're going to charter a plane, we're going to land on this private airstrip that belongs to a cocaine dealer, and then we're going to go up the river, the boats are going to pick you up, right? You get there, day one, no pilot, right? He won't fly into the airstrip. Too dangerous. Well, like, I think 99% of, like, people in production companies would, like, throw in the towel. Oh, you know, plane's not here. Can't do it. You know, shoots off. We go, all right, well, how do we get there? Well, it's a 15-hour drive. Okay, well, let's load up. Let's get some cars. Let's load up, right? And that wasn't the case. Like, we got the plane for that one, but it's those kind of things. Like, here's an instance. In that exact expedition, we showed up. The boats weren't there. Boats didn't have enough fuel to get there. Well, what happens? Well, you got to wait 3 days till the boats can get here. Wow. Okay, so we're going to live in this village with these people for 3 days till the boats get here.
Was it in Colombia where someone in the village, in order to get in there, made you take some sort of...
Jopu,
yeah. This is... I saw you explain this on Rogan. This is just bizarre.
So this is the pipe. But this isn't the pipe. This is the container. There's nothing in here, unfortunately. But so this is, like, to understand how remote this tribe is in the Colombian jungle, right? This is what they store things in. So this is a giant land snail. This is beeswax. This is a monkey's bone. And this is the plug, which is also made out of beeswax. Wow. And they store the jopu in this. Now, the jopu is a combination of tobacco, some kind of jungle roots, and who knows what else, right? And it's this mashed up green powder. And Lorenzo, the shaman of the village, said, look, you want to go up that river to look for that caiman, you have to, it's very dangerous. I was like, well, what do you mean? And we hear these things everywhere we go. We hear it in Zanzibar. We hear it in the Amazon. We hear it everywhere, right? Everywhere is very dangerous. He said, no, this is really dangerous. Like, there's evil spirits up there. We don't even go up there. I was like, well, what do you mean? He's like, well, you know, I said to him, Lorenzo, we have to go up there. That's where I believe this extinct caiman is.
Now, but at the time he's saying this, do you think he's full of it, or do you think there's truth to it?
No, he's definitely not full of it. I mean, one, this is his spiritual belief. It's his lore. It's the same as, you know, me telling a Christian God doesn't exist, right? This is his belief. So, first of all, you don't go, you're a fucking idiot when someone tells you what they believe in. Yeah. You respect it. And the thing is, Lorenzo is the shaman. So if Lorenzo says you can't go without a blessing, well, you better believe you're getting a blessing, right? You're not going to go, fuck you, I'm going anyway. That's not how...
He needs the caiman, so he needs a blessing for the caiman. Right.
Yeah, and Lorenzo, you know, he's the village elder. Like, we don't want to upset him. This is in the middle of FARC rebel-controlled Colombian Amazon. Like, you know, who knows what can happen? So anyway, so Lorenzo says, look, it's very dangerous up there. And it is dangerous because there's huge anacondas up there, there's caiman, there's tons of piranha, there's candiru, there's jaguars, there's everything else, right? And there's tons of FARC rebels running around murdering people. So it's not like, I can understand why someone would say it's dangerous.
Welcome to Colombia.
Exactly, yeah.
Jeez.
So Lorenzo says to me, he says, look, if you want to go up there, you have to be blessed. Like, it's the only way you'll survive. And I was like, well, just me or my whole team? He goes, no, everybody. You know, you're all going up there. You all have to be blessed. I said, well, all right then, you know, what's that involve? He says, well, you have to take the jopu and see if you have a reaction. Well, this is what the jopu lives in, right? And so I say to Lorenzo, all right then, you know, I'm not a drugs guy, like, never done drugs, never done ayahuasca ceremonies or what's the stuff from the cactus?
Peyote,
never done any of that.
Not that I've tried.
Sure. Yeah.
Trust me.
Well, I was on the tip of his tongue, yeah. I didn't even ask, yeah.
Lemur out in the desert, let me tell you.
So, you know, but my point is, like, I'm not into these things, right? Like, it's just not my, never been a recreational drug guy, so I'm pretty nervous. And he says, yeah, look, you need to be cleansed. So he takes out this exact bone, this container right here, and this little V-shaped monkey bone. And he pours this green stuff into the monkey bone, right? And go around in a circle, and you blow, and it goes up into your brain.
What's going through your head while this? Are you worried about this?
Very.
Be worried.
I'm way more nervous of sticking something up my nose than I am,
Wrestling an anaconda.
100%, yeah. Like, one of those I have control over. I don't have control over the green shit that goes into my brain, you know?
So if you can get bit by a shark, you can take some green shit to the brain.
Yeah, there you go. But, yeah, so it goes around the circle, and, you know, a couple of my camera guys do it, my audio guy doesn't, and they're like, whoa, man, that's like, it was best described by my audio tech, Trevor, who said it feels like chlorine in your brain, you know, just like burning, bubbling in your brain. It really did. Anyway, it comes to me, and I'm so nervous, like, my heart's going, I go, like, blow it up there, like, force it, you know, it's supposed to be this long, slow thing.
Right.
Anyway, I just go fucking straight into overtime, and,
immediately.
Can't breathe. Like, just, it takes my breath away. My brain feels like it's melting with acid, and, I'm not having hallucinations or anything, but I'm just break out into this violent sweat, and 30 seconds later, I'm on my hands and knees, just puking my guts out.
What's your team's reaction to this?
They're laughing at me. They've seen me in worse shape.
The elders are probably getting a kick out of this.
Totally. Well, sort of. So Lorenzo at first was sitting there very stoic and watching, Lorenzo being the shaman, and then he started to kind of smile. He was a very stoic man. But the most interesting thing is not me getting sick and feeling terrible. It's when I was, you know, I'm lying on the ground next to a puddle of my own vomit going, I'm sorry, Lorenzo, I don't mean to be offensive. And his response through the translator was, this is not offensive, that's a cleansing. And if you hadn't been cleansed, you're the one that had the bad spirits in you. You're the one who would have died. And I'm the one who has to catch the caiman and wrestle the anacondas and everything else. So I'm the one in trouble's way. So, you know, look, I'm a scientist. I don't believe in oogie boogies, but definitely made me think about it there, where a shaman like that goes, you're the only one who would have been in jeopardy. You're the one who just got puked your guts out, and now you're the one who's going to be safe.
And you were the only one who had that kind of reaction.
The only one. No one else, yeah. So it made you think
Lorenzo
about
Lorenzo could be on to something there.
Yeah, absolutely.
I need Lorenzo to help me out before I do anything, you know, back in L.A. Bring him on over. We'll do some, what is it,
jopu? So
after you do it, though, Forrest, how long are you out of commission for? Did you snap back into it?
No, God. I mean, we don't really have the luxury of, like, you know, there's no going back to the AC'd hotel room and taking a nice hot bubble bath. So, yeah, no, it doesn't really work that way. So that night was a really, really bad night. Like, I was violently sick all night. And then the next day I felt terrible, obviously, as one does after being up all night. So it took a couple days to wear off. But that doesn't slow us down. You know, we still had to leave the next morning at 4 a.m., had to load the boats, had to go, I think we went 18 miles upriver from that first day. So.
And what did you say you were looking for on this trip?
Cayman.
A Cayman, yeah. Rio Apoporis Cayman.
And was that the same experience you had where you got into it with an anaconda?
Yeah.
Same trip?
Yeah. So we were a week or so into the expedition, and I actually believed I had seen the Rio Apoporis Cayman at this time, but my camera crew was like, sure you have, buddy, because they hadn't seen it and they hadn't got a shot, and I had just been seeing it in the distance. And we stumbled across this like 16, maybe 18-foot anaconda, and my brain went straight to, okay, we haven't found our Cayman, but an anaconda this size would be preying on Cayman. Like, that would be one of their main diets. So if we can catch this anaconda and it defecates, we can test that fecal sample to see if it's been eating our extinct Cayman, and that'll give us genetic proof. So you know,
to wrestle an 18-foot anaconda to take a look at its shit.
To let it shit on me, not just to take a look at it. I had to wrestle an 18-foot anaconda to let it shit on me so I could test its shit. We never ended up having to test the shit because we found the Cayman 2 days later, but it, you know, it was a step in the right direction.
Also, what if the anaconda didn't eat that day? It may not have the shit.
But you're throwing the Hail Mary when you're out there looking for an extinct animal.
But when you're going after the anaconda, so what do you have to do in order to get it to shit? Do you just kind of have to wait? Do you have to?
No, most snakes, when they're threatened, will defecate. That's part of what they do. They, especially aquatic snakes like an anaconda, they have really stinky, disgusting musk and poop.
Right.
And so that's part of their defense mechanism. So as a last defense, once they're done biting you and trying to attack you and trying to constrict you, they will release their bowels. And that's where we were at with this one. We caught it. You know, I had one of my main camera guys, Mark, hold his head, and I worked on his back end, and after, not even long, maybe 3 minutes, he just shit all over me.
But they can eat even, like deer and all sorts of stuff, like you. Yeah.
Absolutely. But, you know, like our stomachs, like, you know, if you eat a hamburger today, it's not gone tomorrow. It's going to sit in there and come out for the next 4 or 5 days. And so, you know, we were in an area that I believe the Cayman were. I had seen the eye shine, which is the reflective eyeballs of what I thought were the animals we were looking for. And so this was, you know, if I'd gone home and come back to Discovery and been like, I think it's there, and I brought back this bottle of shit, I think they would have been like, fuck you. But yeah, it was still the best I had.
Yeah,
it was the best I could do at the time. And so, you know, we had to do it.
Of course, is there any times when you're out there where somebody, maybe, you know, someone in the village or something, obviously you're very well educated with medicine and all that, where you had to jump in to save somebody that lives there, a local or whatnot, from an animal?
When I was in Myanmar, so I created, sold, and produced a show for the History Channel called Face the Beast. Awesome show. And on that show, we retraced the steps of notable animal mass murders. And one of these notable animal mass murders was the Battle of Ramri. For anybody that doesn't know, the Battle of Ramri was... The Japanese were occupying Ramri Island in Myanmar, Burma at the time, and the English came in, the Allies came in, and chased the Japanese into the swamps. And in the course of 2 days, 1,000 Japanese soldiers were eaten by crocodiles.
Oh. By crocodiles?
Yeah, 1,000 of them. So we went back to Ramri to this is not normal, right? It doesn't matter if 1,000 of us run through the swamps of Florida, if we run through the Zambezi River in Africa, the Nile River, the swamps of Australia, we're not going to get eaten by crocodiles. So this is a very bizarre situation. Why did this happen? So this is what I went to investigate. Not on camera. I was the producer. I was off camera. We had some fantastic guys that were on camera doing it for History Channel. Anyway, this is the precursor to me telling you that we went to Ramri Island. We were about 10 days into this retracing of the steps, and we get a call from, and there's no call because there's no phones, we're in the middle of nowhere, Myanmar. We hear from screaming that in the village, like basically across the river, a boy has been attacked by a crocodile. So we rush over there, and as I get there, I see this young boy, he's probably about 16 years old, he was out crab fishing, and he's been grabbed by this huge saltwater crocodile. I could show you photos if you like. It's pretty graphic.
So you just know did somebody from there come and get you?
Yes, they ran to us. No, they came to get us. They didn't know what to do. Their mother was crying. She had already written her son off as dead. He was not unconscious, but he was very, very close. His arm was completely... So when crocodiles attack, they go into a death roll. So they bite and they spin, right? And they do that to rip the limbs off of their victims in order to make them bleed out and die.
Well,
so this...
I was going to do against Saquon Barkley.
This boy had been grabbed on the arm by a crocodile that got into a death roll. So he had lacerations all down his arm. It was broken in about 14 places. He had also been grabbed in the thigh, and it was right next to his femoral artery. So he stabilized that, bandaged up his arm and everything else. But he was going into shock, and he was definitely going to go into sepsis and die. So I'm EMT trained, so I'm medically trained, mostly for stitching myself up, but it was something I wanted to do when I was younger. And so we saved that boy's life. His arm had to be amputated. Because of the severity of the injury, but he lived because we were there.
Did you have to wrestle him away from the crocodile?
No, yeah, no. So he had a friend with him when he was fishing, and the friend pulled him into the boat somehow. So he was already in the village by the time we got there, just bleeding out, basically.
Oh my God. And what did you stitch him with? You had some, like, materials?
Yeah, I take a med kit with me.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so what was his other option? I mean, in all honesty, if you weren't there...
He would have died.
There's nothing they could...
There was no other option, yeah. I mean, we were like 12-ish hours from the nearest hospital by boat, and they didn't even have speedboats. They had rowboats. So, you know, for him, it was a 3 or 4 day paddle, and he couldn't paddle, obviously. And yeah, no, he had been brought into the village, and his mother had already written him off as dead. So we saved that boy's life.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You'll never probably hear from him again because he's in a remote jungle.
No, I don't even know his name.
That's amazing.
You know, he was just some young boy, and we happened to be there, and we bandaged him up.
Was there an instance where you had to fight off an animal off of somebody?
No. No, I don't think so. I mean, I've fought animals off of myself, and what I mean by that is if I'm wrestling an anaconda and it's trying to bite me or you know, I'm being charged by something, you know, I evade it. But no, I've never had to, like, step in and physically pull an animal off of someone. That's never happened.
Now, Forrest, I have a question for you. Like, growing up, you said you wanted to work with animals. It was your lifelong dream. Did you have any inspiration? You know, I grew up watching, you know, The Crocodile Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
Was there anybody who kind of inspired you, or was it just that you were growing up in Zimbabwe that you just really loved it? Or is there anybody, you know, that you really looked up to who was kind of in your field prior to you doing this?
Yeah, that's a good question. Look, my grandfather and my mother, also my grandfather on my mother's side, my grandfather on my mother's side and my mother, they were both very kind of wild bushmen. My grandfather discovered a coelacanth, one of the first ever specimens of an animal that hadn't been seen for 666 million years. Wow. In a fish market in the Comores, and said he wasn't a biologist, he wasn't an adventurer, he was an avid adventurer, but he wasn't by trade. He owned a retail store, you know. He just he saw this thing and said something's off here, and you know, that was a discovery he made in a fish market.
It runs in the family, huh?
Yeah, my mother was the first ever female safari guide in Southern Africa and first ever bush pilot. So, you know, it runs in the family. So went from my grandfather to my mother, and now it's on me, and I hope one day my kids.
You must have known because they gave you the name Forrest. I mean, how fitting is that?
I mean, Forrest, you could not be an accountant. You just said this was, they just stuck you in there.
Forrest Whitaker, he's a movie star. But
my sister's name is Summer, and she works in fashion, you know, so you never know. Like, it's not, you know, it wasn't predestined, but yeah, no, I'm very... I think, you know, my grandfather passed away a number of years ago before I worked in television. I think I've lived up to his legacy. I know my mother's very proud. So, yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty happy about that.
one of the questions, we do a thing for a show called the Ask Bob segment. So whoever we're going to have on, I have the fans give a question. One of the most common questions I got was, what's an animal where people should be most afraid of that they don't know? I think everyone thinks sharks and snakes. We all saw the way I was in your living room just now with snakes.
Yeah.
That I've heard you say on interviews, that's not what to be worried about. What should you worry about?
Mosquitoes.
That's the right answer.
Look at Joey Coldcuts.
Yeah. The number one killer of all people.
He fits 100%. The part, huh?
That's the answer.
If you need an intern, you know?
Yeah, that's yeah. That's the answer, man.
Joey,
I'm not,
Forrest.
It's not the stuff that you can see that kills you. It's the parasites. It's the mosquitoes. Those are the dangerous things.
Because you can't see it coming?
You don't see... I mean, I've sat in places where, I kid you not, and this is not an exaggeration, I've had maybe 8 to 10,000 mosquitoes on me at once. Now,
8 to 10,000.
Yeah, if you're wearing short sleeves, your arms go black with them in certain environments.
Itchy the next day.
It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible.
I'm throwing a fit about a couple bug bites
These pearls
by the pig. Yeah.
Yeah, these creamy thighs of yours wouldn't do so well. But here's the thing. If you let's say it's 200, not 8,000, right?
Yeah.
If one of those 200, one of those 8,000 has dengue fever, has malaria, you're done. That's it. Right? You could see the shark coming in the clear water. You could see the croc sitting in the pond, right? You have to get in to fuck with those. You know where the lion's hanging out, right? You could pick up the snake or walk away from it. You can't get away from those mosquitoes. And you don't know which one of those 8,000 has malaria.
Now, you got to probably keep very composed in a situation like that, because if you freak out, they'll probably bite even more, no?
The mosquitoes? I mean, you know, we cover up, we wear bug spray, all that kind of stuff, but it's just like...
Has there been a mosquito instance on one of the trips where somebody had got it?
On the very first television show I ever did, my partner in the show, her name was Manu, she got hemorrhagic dengue fever. So that means her brain started to bleed to the point that she nearly lost her life. So she spent 3 weeks in a hospital after that, and that was just from a mosquito bite, you know?
And is
this is nothing. That's a shark bite, right? That was, yeah, I got lucky because it was a single tooth instead of my whole arm. But that was some duct tape, and I was working an hour later, right?
Did the tooth stick in you?
No, that was I pulled my hand back right at the last second, and just one tooth nicked me.
Like a necklace or something.
No, I got lucky. I mean, if I had waited another second, that would have been my whole hand, and I would have lost the hand for sure.
Oh.
But my point is not that this is scary, right? That's that's what the result of a quick reaction of a shark bite is. The result of a mosquito with hemorrhagic dengue biting you is Manu very nearly lost her life. I was back to work 30 minutes later. I duct taped this up. I was good to go.
So you did go right back to it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm in the middle. I was 200 miles from the nearest coastline. Like, I'm not, you know, taped it up. I'm there to work.
You would have taken a two-week hiatus.
Oh, yeah, you were a little well away from me. So what about even, and the mosquito thing, and now that, you know, you explain it, that does make a lot of sense since you can't see it coming. What about something that you can see coming that I don't think you would be afraid of, but that is a, that's something to fear?
Anywhere in the world?
Yeah.
There's something that you can see coming I am deathly afraid of. Like, I don't know. If you're not afraid of them, you're a freaking idiot. Hippopotamus.
Hippos.
Humongous. I saw them at the San Diego Zoo. Those things are huge.
And they're extremely territorial, extremely aggressive. They're a very nervous animal, so they're on edge all the time. Yeah, they're very erratic. They're unpredictable. They are super... And people look at them, I think they think Fantasia, like the pink dancing hippo with the smile on their face. You have no idea how dangerous hippos are. They account for more large animal deaths in Africa than anything else.
So the girl said, I want a hippopotamus for Christmas. She needs to retrain her
wishes. Yeah, yeah. Her ass needs to get to the Zambezi River in Africa and think about that for a minute.
She's going to be disappointed.
No, it's yeah, they're very, very scary animals.
So is that an animal that you will not deal with?
No, I've unfortunately dealt with them many times.
Of course, yeah.
So look, for me, it's like the more that it pushes the boundary of misunderstanding, the more I appreciate the animal, right? So taking the extinct, edge of extinct things out of the equation, common animals, right? I love diving with sharks. It's a fantastic experience. It shows the world that these animals that when Jaws came out, we thought if you were even in the water near one, you were going to die, shows the world that that's not the case. About 6 years ago, my cameraman and I created a documentary on swimming with crocodiles. We were one of the first people to ever swim with crocodiles without cages to show, look, these animals are just misunderstood. Yes, they're very dangerous, but in the right situation, they can be explored and enjoyed. I don't encourage this for everybody by any means, but my point was just to show that these animals are misunderstood. Hippos are like in that same category, right? They're very dangerous. They're very erratic. They're very moody. Nobody's ever swum with them successfully yet.
Here comes Forrest.
But they're very, very scary animals.
And you know, something that I couldn't leave here without asking, when you're on one of these trips, has there ever been a time where you said, this is my last one, where it's gotten so severe to where it's like, I don't know how much longer I can do this, or you're just pedal to the metal?
No, I've never felt that way. I mean, I've been on death's door with ailments and sicknesses and mosquito bites and everything else and been miserable at the time. But by the time I'm back in the hotel room in the city before the flight out the next day, I'm ready to go again.
Right back to it.
Right, like, I don't like this. I live in a beautiful place. I live in Santa Barbara. It's one of the most gorgeous places in the entire world. I hate it. Get me out of here. Put me in a tent. Put me in the mud. Get me into the jungle or the Arctic. That's where I'm most comfortable. I love it. I don't like development and structure.
You know, it's very few times do you get to say you're actually doing something that you love to do. You could just tell that you just love doing it. Even love walking it. Around, I mean, you could just see your passion for it.
Yeah.
It's really neat.
Thank you.
What would your advice be for young kids? You know, obviously they watch your show. They really grow up, you know, idolizing you. Somebody who wants to get into that field, what would be your biggest advice for them moving forward if they want to do something along
Do it, man. Like, I didn't think I was ever going to work in television. You know, I didn't think I was going to have a TV show. Don't do it because you want to have a TV show. You know, do it because you love wildlife. Do it because you have a passion for the outdoors or adventure. If you ask me to go climb Everest tomorrow, I'd tell you to get fucked. But if you told me there was an extinct Himalayan quail on the tip top of Everest, I'd be the first guy up Everest, guaranteed.
I would tell you to go get fucked.
Yeah. But, like, that's what I mean. Like, do it because you have a passion for it, right? Don't do it to challenge yourself. Don't do it because it's cool. Don't do it because you think there's fame and glory associated with it. If you have a passion for working with conservation and wildlife, like so many of these kids that message me every day, like the people you're talking about, do it. Are you going to be working with lions in the savannah of Africa next week? No, you're not. You know, I spent years picking weeds and counting ants and flipping over logs and looking at earthworms. Not kidding. These are actual jobs I had before I got anywhere near what I'm doing now.
How do you apply for something like that?
For a biology job?
Yeah, like how do you go about that?
It's, you know, you go to school, you get a degree in biology, you start working as a field tech. The techs do the shit work, right? Like, you start off at the very bottom. You're literally the ant counter on an invasive ant project, or the guy that's pulling weeds up on top of the mountain because they're invasive. It's not fun work, you know, but if you're passionate about it, you find joy. Like the Marines say, you embrace the suck,
yeah.
You know, and you find joy in what you're doing. And you start to meet people. Like, say all three of us are out there picking weeds on Santa Cruz Island because they're invasive, right? Well, we start talking, well, we want to work with the foxes on the island, right? Cool, well, we're all techs. Maybe next job we apply for, now that we have some credibility to our name as being good techs, is we're the fox techs. Okay, now we've done the tech work for the foxes, maybe we can be the trappers or the collarers. You know, nothing happens overnight. If you love it, you just got to keep working at it. And that's how I've got to where I am. If the TV show goes kaput tomorrow, will I be bummed? Fuck yeah, I'll be bummed. Is it going to stop me? No. I'll still be out in the bush next week, you know?
Speaking of TV shows, if I may, how much did Steve Irwin have an effect on your career? In your life?
Steve Irwin is an incredible man, and I will always, always love and respect him for what he did, because he brought the joy and wonder of wildlife into the homes of millions of people all across the world. And I have more impact and influence from that man in my today life than I ever did before. Yes, I saw him on TV occasionally. I was usually too busy in the bush. But today, he is the golden child, the mark of success in this world, of inspiring people to care about for wildlife. No matter what I accomplish, no matter how many extinct animals I find, I don't know how I could ever top what Steve Irwin did, and I never want to. I don't like being compared to him because he is in a class of his own. He's a wonderful, incredible man. His family are amazing people, and they're doing incredible things. And, you know, cheers to Steve Irwin, because, yeah, salute to Steve. A wonderful human being.
Forrest, you could not have been more welcoming for us. This has been an experience for me like you wouldn't believe. Just wait till you get a hold of the video. We got me seeing the animals and whatnot. Cold cuts, thanks for being aboard. But this was awesome. You're fascinating.
Thanks, guys. Well, I enjoyed having you, so thank you so much. Thanks for making the trip, boys. Yeah, thank you so much.
Hi there, we are James and Dan Twofort of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favorite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's mind.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot.
Very good. I go on here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words Jesus Saves written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.